Accession number 26755, Reel 1.
Seven, five, nine, four, 924. Ronald Charles Savage, his memoirs. My father was a regular in the Royal Corps of Signals, and we had travelled around the UK, of course. And then he realised that he shortly would be due for a posting to India, as was the custom in those days. And not knowing what the style of education was out there, he had decided to try and get me into the Duke of York's Royal Military School at Dover. He was successful, and I started there on the age of 11 and a half in September 1935, going there with my mother and her father, my grandfather. It was all very strange to me, of course, but having been brought up more or less in a military life all the time, it wasn't too strange. I enjoyed myself. I left there on beginning of May at the age of 15 and 1 week, having reached the dizzy heights of corporal. I'd been in the band playing cymbals and reserve bass drummer and playing my own private clarinet. There were six of us, which we all went together. We took the oath of allegiance on Monday the 1st of May, and on Tuesday the 2nd, we all went up to Arborfield. The six of us, myself of course, Leslie Tedder, Bunny Abbott, Dick Wade, Meeking, Dusky Clemens. When we got there, we all finished up in A block, naturally all being together. Funnily enough, six chaps from the Queen Victoria School at Dunblane, Scottish school, similar to ours, started just after the Boer War. They were in B block. Every year we had competitions with them with rifle sports and so forth. One year we went to them, and the next year they came to us. So of course the rivalry was still there, and it finished up with pillow fights between half a dozen on one side and those on the other. But before long it extended to A block versus B block, and it got a little bit out of hand, so it had to be called to a stop. It was great fun though in those days, and we all had the advantage, having had military training and being in boarding school and away from our parents. Of course some of the chaps didn't have parents, one or the other, or in some cases both. So the other fellows that came straight from Civvy Street, we were that much ahead of them, and we more or less took them in hand and mollycoddled them and nursed them and showed them what to do to the best of our ability. I remember when the war broke out, we hadn't got any inclination of, I hadn't anyway, any intimation of war coming, because we didn't have any daily papers available, and we all marched in, just the two companies of us in those days, into the NAFI, into the main building, and the radio was being set up in there, and it was switched on, and we heard the Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, making his speech and finishing up, as a result we are at war with Germany. I don't know really what I felt about it. It was just one of those things. I was in the army, I was a soldier and all sorts, and that's the sort of thing we were expected to do, go to war sooner or later. So there we were. We had a colonel at the time, a chap, Folks, a bit of a, and he was good-hearted, but he was one of these old dugout type, and we used to call him Fuffy Folks. And he had an old car, and whenever the air raid sirens went, he used to come belting down from his house nearby, flat out in bottom gear, revving like the clappers. I always remember they gave us a big talk after the announcement of war being declared and finishing up with "Courage, mes enfants." Well, very few of the blokes attained French school. I think it was a bit above their heads. In October 1939, there was a big influx of new chaps coming into the school. So we fellows in A and B company were then split up to form nuclei of the other companies. Together with two or three of the chaps from the Duke of York's school, I went to D company. It was quite a nice setup. We enjoyed ourselves. The only thing was, well, we were issued with our kit in May. Our greatcoats had been supplied with Royal Army Ordnance Corps buttons. With the opening of the war and the crowd coming in October, all they had were general service buttons. The greatcoats had to be folded up dolly fashion and hung outside the barrack room and the row of hooks. And lo and behold, all the ROC buttons disappeared. And we had to go and buy ourselves replacement buttons, and of course all we could get was the general service. So that's all we had for the rest of the war. Such being that my naivety, that I was just so disappointed with the sort of people that we had that could stoop to things like that. I should have been warned, because some of us had bicycles, and they were kept in a store, in a room, in the barrack block, and although they were padlocked, it didn't take anybody long to pick it. And you'd find dynamos and lighting sets pinched from the bicycles. And it was a great pity. At school, we respected each other's belongings, and that was that. And of course, I expected to do the same in the army. And disabused with that idea, of course. I remember in the first day of national prayer declared by the King in 1940, very low cloud ceiling overhead, we were busy polishing up ready for the church parade, and we heard a plane buzzing around. We nipped outside to have a look, and it came down below the clouds, coming straight for us along the road. And a chap, one of them, said, "Look, it's engines on fire." And somebody else said, "Engine on fire, be damned, it's firing at us." And somebody else said, it's one of ours. And one of the PSIs came in and said, get inside, you damn fools. It's Jerry. And it was a Messerschmitt 110. He didn't hit anybody here. He swung round, and a nearby artillery camp of conscripts for initial training, they're all on parade, all lined up, and the twit with a Lewis gun opened up, which caught the attention of the pilot, who came along, and they strafed the whole row of chaps in the lined up there, and didn't hit one, but knocked the hat off the last bloke in the rear rank. I've never forgotten it. Whether it was done deliberately, they missed them and just put the fear of God, I don't know. And he swung round again, dropped an, I suppose about 250 pounder, something like that. And all it did was kill a cow in the field. Such as our introduction to the hardships of war. I remember sitting up on the roof, looking over toward London when the Blitz was on, and seeing all the glare of this of the light searchlights and the tracer going up and the shells exploding and these things. I'm afraid I didn't do all that well when it came to bench work. My work wasn't a patch on some of the real outstanding stuff. In fact, I was very nearly turfed out and whipped up in front of the commandant, and I asked him to give me another chance, and I transferred to a different training squad where the staff sergeant in charge had a different outlook and helped me quite a bit, and owing to his intercession or interest in to his training, I stayed in. I finished in October 41 at 17 and a half, when the new minimum age for man service was introduced. And from 11 pence a day, which is just under 5 pence of today's money, I jumped to 3 and 9 pence a day. And dreams of avarice really were something in those days. But we're never all that well paid. And judging by, I don't know what it's like today compared to outside wages, but we didn't get all that much then, even as tradesmen. I remember in the early days at Barberfield, we had first RSM with a Grenadier Guards chappie, Ben Cook. He was quite a character. I remember being told to go and lock myself up in the guard room and bring him the key. He used to terrify us until he had some of the Jankerwallers, chaps confined to barracks, down at his house doing some gardening. That was really an eye-opener, because it turned out that he was under his wife's thumb, and his terror soon dissipated. Actually, he was quite a nice bloke at heart, and I can remember when he was commissioned as lieutenant and quartermaster, he had a peculiar portly way of walking along, and as we flung him one up in a smart salute, he put two fingers to the peak of his cap and just carry on as though nothing had happened. There was no side to him at all. Shortly after the outbreak of war, some members of the 4th 7th Dragoon Guards regimental band were posted to the school. I should imagine they were medically unfit for overseas service, together with the bandmaster W01 Nell. And various chaps from different schools who played instruments were all asked to join. I did as well, and we had quite a nice little set up. In fact, I have given a photograph to the archives of the band on the stage. I and Master Nell, a mixture of 4th Sun Dragoon Guards and the ROC members. I always looked upon it as being our band and not 4th Sun Dragoon Guards. I always looked upon them as attached to us. It was fun. We used to play for the church parade and church services and so on. And at one time, I remember a theatre was got up, not theatre, but musical evening. And another chap and myself were detailed to play. He was to play the mouth organ, and I was to accompany him on my clarinet. Without music to read, I'm hopeless, or was hopeless. And all I could do was get a couple of squawks. Well, he didn't do all that good either. Not to worry, it had its good points. They never asked me to do anything like it again. I'm afraid the memoirs are going to be a bit disjointed. I keep jumping here and there. One chap I remember was a fellow Rex Bryant, 4903. His family and mine were neighbours out in India, and I believe way back in the early days of the Signals, although I don't remember him before then. I've got a photograph of him, myself, with his mother in the middle, taken, well, must have been in the first 3 or 4 months of our service, certainly before the war. I also have a photograph of 5 Duke York school chaps when we first went to Arborfield, and the PSI in the background. I said, imagine, the photograph must have been taken by Dusky Clement, because he was not in the group. But unfortunately, I've lost the original, and photocopies that I do have are unsuitable for reproduction in the Arborfield magazine, so we've lost that on that one. We had an ambulance and a team of 4 Fanny First Aid Nursing Yeomanry lady drivers attached to the school. First of all, in early days, they were billeted in a wing of the hospital at the school. But shortly, after a few months, they were given a house not nearby, requisition or whatever, I don't know. I had to go to Aldershot a couple of times with one of them, a young blonde, Miss Poole, or Pooley as she was called by the others. A gorgeous lass, and I had quite a crush on her. They had been given a rusty old motorbike, and she asked me if I could do anything with it. I used to put the tools in my gas mask carrier and go up there and see what I could do. Until one day, I was stopped at the gate going out to the camp, and my carrier was checked and the tools were found, and that got me in trouble, because it was suspected that I was taking them outside to flog, which was incorrect, of course. But nevertheless, I finished up on Jankers. Served me right, I suppose. I often wonder what happened to Pooley. She's a gorgeous lass. Lovely blonde, blue eyed, oh, wow. Of such things are memories made. In those days, there was no passing out parade, as I believe there is today. We used to just finish our time at school and disappear overnight, almost posted to whatever destination it was to be. We were given the option of trying to get as near to our hometown as possible. I never really had one, being with Dad in the services, travelling everywhere. My birthplace was Stratford-on-Avon. That's only because they came from there in the first place, and Mother went back to her people to have me. But I asked for that, and the nearest they could get for me was at Wolverhampton, a little place called Wensfield, 11th ACAC Workshops. I went there with another chap, and I was given the documents, and we reported to the office there, and full of the joys of spring and smart and what have you, and asked a few questions and answered them. I'm on my way out, and one of the staff sergeants called out, "Savage." "Staff," said I, or in the best manner. "Ex-boy, are you?" "Yes, staff," said I proudly. Thought as much, was the reply. I went out with my tail between my legs. I lasted about 5 months there at Wolverhampton, Wensfield, 11th ACAC Division Workshops. But, I don't know, after that start, I rather took the heart out of me. Anyway, after about 4 or 5 months there, I was posted down to Truro. But the workshops were the garage on the, you can't call it the seafront, because it was really an inlet from the main sea. But the tide reached up that far. I was rather stupid one day. I don't know how it happened, but I got splashed with petrol, and I decided to carry out an experiment. I had my lighter, I used to smoke in those days, and I put it close to, working close to the to my overalls until the gas ignited. What I hadn't anticipated was the fact that it would be quite a flame, and while I was trying to beat it out, I thought, well, the best thing to do is to run out across the road and jump into the river. However, on my way through the workshop, one of the staff sergeants grabbed me and wrapped me in a blanket and put it in the time-honored manner. I finished up just outside Keynsham, between Bristol and Bath. The three or four of us there. And we used to go once a week into Bristol to continue school learning towards getting our first-class educational certificate. Of course, the school thought we were there for mornings only. The unit thought we were there all day. So we went to school in the morning, had lunch in a transport cafe. You could get a good meal for a reasonable sum in those days. And in the afternoon, we'd go to the cinema. But you can't keep a good X right down, can you? And then I blotted my copybook. On paper, it looks really very bad on my record. Because I had a bottom bunk. I remember in those days I had a double bunk. It was behind the blackout shelter, which was round the doorway to the entrance to the mission hut. Ideal, because I had a couple of extra moments in bed before the orderly sergeant could get round and make me and jump out of bed smartly. I went on leave. When I came back, the lance corporal in charge of the hut had moved into my bed and put my stuff onto his old bed. Well, I, I remonstrated but got nowhere. Anyway, a few weeks later, he went on leave. What would you do? I did. Moved my stuff back into my old bed and put his back where he came from. He came off leave, told me to get out. I said, not likely, or words to that effect. And he put me on a 252 for refusing to obey an order. Well, I wasn't aware. I mean, it's an unlawful order anyway. He whipped me in front of the old man, and to my astonishment, I received 10 days field punishment. Not CB, field punishment. Struth, I had visions of being sent away and be tied to the wheels of some blooming piece of artillery, you know, in the old days. Anyway, it was rather a farce in the end, because the Nissen hut, where the guard room was, one half was the guard room and the other half was a sports store. There was one spare bed, double bunk, in the guard room, and I had to sleep there. No cell as such. Well, the lads knew what had happened. Of course, they came in late at night and booking in midnight and so on, and they're all heaping cigarettes on my bed. I smoke like a chimney. And, I used to do the usual janker's job and so on, although I was really field punishment, and to make sure that I was not likely to escape, I was always accompanied by regimental policeman during the day or a member of the guard at night. And I can remember one night being escorted across to the cookhouse for my supper, and the chap had a rifle, one of the Canadian rifles with a bayonet, a long bayonet on the end of it, which when he ground put the butt of the rifle on the ground, the tip of the bayonet was just above his head. I used to hold my hand going across in the blackout in case he lost me. Laugh? Eventually, about 3 days before my 10 days was up, the skipper sent for me because there's a bit of a quandary. A deserter had been arrested by the local police, and as we were the nearest military unit, he'd been handed over to us. But there's only one bed in the guard room that they could put for the prisoner, and I had it. So the old man put me on my honour not to try and escape for the next 3 days. So they had somewhere to put the escape, the deserter. God. Talk about Kate Connor's army. I never heard the like of it. A few months later, I was posted away to Charminster, just outside Dorchester. And that's a very nice place there. And had some ATS girls there. I wasn't bothered about them. But a chap named Orchard, a very keen lad, he made himself a rifle. And I always remember when it was completed. He took it outside one Saturday afternoon and put a round in the breech. I wouldn't know whether it was live or blank. And then fired the rifle with a string attached to the trigger, operated from some distance. It worked. I had started a little scheme whereby I had threatening bits. I used to file them down and make little crosses out of them. They were greatly in demand among the ATS girls. I became friendly with the ATS sergeant, Sellout Montfort. She was a honey. She was a few years older than I, 4 or 5, and really she was like an older sister to me. We both used to like walking in stormy weather. I can remember walking along the cliffs above Weymouth, where greatcoats, collar turned up, rain beating our faces and real stormy weather, and thoroughly enjoying ourselves.